Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, we brought together Lauren Bewkes, author of best-selling novel The Shining Girls, and celebrated crime author John Connolly, best known for his P.I. Charlie Parker series, to share their best tips and tricks to convey authenticity. Learn how acclaimed writers bring stories vividly to life, ensuring readers are fully engaged and invest in the narrative. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, our authors will reveal their secrets for creating immersive scene settings and worlds.
Good morning. Thank you for coming out so early on a Sunday morning. If you're anything like me, you like to invent three impossible worlds before breakfast anyway. My name's David Barnett. I'm an author and journalist, and we're speaking today to Lauren Bewkes, who's an author and was a journalist, and John Connolly, who's an author and was a journalist. We're talking about world building. I'm guessing some people here are writers as well, and maybe you want to get a bit of the secret source of world building. So we will have a lot of time at the end for questions, so please do ask some, because I said that yesterday at the event and there was stony silence and I had to resort to my emergency questions. Nobody wants those today, I'm telling you. So, in fact, John and Lauren, you introduce yourselves and tell us about your latest book.
My name is John Connolly. Just published a book called The Instruments of Darkness, which is, I think, the 20th or 21st in a series of novels. But I've written other things. I've written, they're detective novels, but I've written science fiction and fantasy and dabbled in literary fiction as well and short stories. And the new book is set in Maine. And as you can tell from me, I'm not actually from there. My west, Wild West, is Connemara. So I write about a place that is geographically distant from where I live.
I'm Lauren Bewkes. I'm the author of The Shining Girls, which is now an Apple TV show with Elizabeth Moss and Jamie Bell, who is the perfect incel serial killer. He's wonderful. My new book's called Bridge. I kind of write high-concept thrillers with genre elements. Bridge is about a young woman her mother has just died, and she is left behind an artifact that lets you access other realities. And maybe her mother is alive in one, and she can find her and resolve, you know, kind of their relationship. But there's also someone else looking for this artifact who's probably my favorite villain that I've ever written.
World building. So it's perhaps something that you first think of when you're maybe thinking of someone who's doing sort of an epic fantasy novel or
maps,
a science fiction novel where you're in, you know, the far future and distant space, and you're sort of starting with a Westeros or a Middle Earth from scratch. But every novel has to have some element of world building, doesn't it? Even a hyper-realistic literary novel is still set in a made-up world, no matter how close it is to ours. So I suppose when you're writing a novel set in the present, there's kind of some presumption that people will know certain things about that world, and you wouldn't set a novel in New York City and then have to explain what the Statue of Liberty is and why it's there, would you? There are certain things that we kind of like take for granted in sort of contemporary novels, would you say? It's even a question, is it, that?
not so much a question as a comment.
Yeah.
I think Eudora Welty said that location is the crossroads of circumstance. So you need to treat location like a character in your book. It is another character. And I think when you're talking about a city that people are very familiar with, yes, there is a kind of shorthand. You don't have to explain to people, as it was said, what, you know, where the Statue of Liberty is. About a month or so ago, I had to talk on radio about Stephen King because Carrie had turned, what was 50? Was Carrie turning 50?
And your book is set in Maine.
And I said in Maine, yeah. And also because I'm one of the few people in who wasn't for a long time ashamed to admit that he read genre fiction. So you've become the default guy to talk to. And remember, the interviewer was really not, he wasn't a fan of King. I don't think he read anything that wasn't nonfiction and felt this was all a little bit beneath him. But he had to do this as part of the show anyway. And his thing was, oh, well, you know, you know, King is a horror writer, and these are what is important in these books is the supernatural elements. And actually, the point I was trying to make was that what King does very well is build the ordinary. The world that he, the world of Maine that he presents is very mundane. He writes very well about the everyday. So he writes very well about, he's quite good on the geography of small towns. And quite often he's, you know, he's given alternative names to places that really exist. So, you know, Derry and Belfast or places like Bangor or Belfast, Maine. So he does those things very well. He constructs a recognizable world that can be familiar to people even if they've never been there. And then when you get the intrusion, and again, no matter what kind of novel you're writing, whether it's a fantasy novel or a crime novel or a horror novel or a piece of literary fiction, it's about an event. Something happens that is not part of the ordinary. But if you get the ordinary right, that very mundane world-building right, the impact of the event is so much more profound. And that doesn't mean you have to name every street and give people, you know, 10 maps, because I always kind of, my heart always sinks a little bit when I get a map at the start of a book. It's always like, you know, when you get a list of characters, it sort of sinks you, this book is going to be hard work. So if you can avoid that, that is great. But to give little people shorthand, little references to places, little references to things, a sense of the familiar, that makes the unfamiliar and the extraordinary that much more impactful, I think.
Yeah, so, you know, my books always have a genre element. But my theory is that when you're writing about the incredible, you have to have really credible details to hang it on. So research for me is like the very important thing. And I did a lot of research on Detroit when my novel Broken Monsters is set. And I read a lot of books by Charlie LaDuff on like the police system and how broken it was. And then I went to go and interview cops in Detroit. And they took me around to the old police station, which was beautiful. And it's like, you know, one times detective room with the glass doors and these old typewriters and filing cabinets and the interrogation room with scary graffiti like scrawled on it. And that was 100% not the real Detroit police station now. They'd shut the whole thing down. They built this new thing with cubicles and just like cubicle hell. They had a gym upstairs. All the cars had been redone. And I'd already written the police scenes. And I was like, oh, God. And I know that in fiction, that's what people want. They want like the noirish feel. But I was like, it's not representative of what's actually happening. So I went against kind of the authorial instinct to like make this beautiful, dilapidated police station to go with what was actually happening. Because I do think we have a responsibility to truth. And reality, and especially if you're writing about a place, you want people who live there to be like, yeah, you got it.
Yeah, you don't want to kind of like offend or turn off the people who have the intimate knowledge of that place you're writing about. And I mean, your early novels were kind of set in Cape Town.
And Johannesburg.
And given that the biggest, obviously, English-speaking markets are the US and the UK, did you feel kind of... Do you feel a sense that you had to kind of like maybe explain more for an international market than you would have done if it was only going to be read in South Africa?
Absolutely. So Moxieland was written in South Africa for a South African audience. With Zoo City, I got an international deal. So I was aware that I was writing for an international audience. And some of the foreign editions, they've got a glossary of terms. But I put enough context in there that you can kind of figure it out. You know, so if the character's sitting drunk on the stairs necking a Langola Langola, it's some kind of alcohol. Like, deal with it, you know. But it was interesting to kind of be aware of that. But there is a lot of stuff in all of my books, even though the new ones are set in America, there's a lot of in-jokes specifically for South Africans.
Yeah.
And it's only if you're a South African, you'll get it.
In terms of introducing your setting, if it's something that's kind of... if it's something, say it's New York, which we all have a familiarity with, even if we've never been there, it's... Is that easier than sort of setting it in maybe a small town that people are less familiar with in terms of kind of how you introduce the elements? Or is there kind of a bit of universality in terms of storytelling, how the setting unfolds?
So I've specifically chosen not to set any of my books in New York. The Shining Girls are set in Chicago because I'd lived in New York and Chicago because I've seen New York so many times and it's a bit boring. You know, and I feel like trying to find those interesting details by going to a place, by finding out, kind of, you know, hang out with locals, interviewing locals, that to me makes it more interesting and more real. Because I think we have this imagined scape of the big cities already. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I tend to try and shy away from them. It was one of the reasons why I ended up writing about Maine. I mean, I ended up in Maine slightly by accident. I'd actually ended up a bit like Whitnail and I. I ended up in Delaware by accident. I'd got a job in Delaware, and when I was younger, I was in my 20s. This was before, I'd always dabbled in writing, but I hadn't really thought about being a writer. So I got offered the job in Delaware, and I thought, this is great. I'm going to meet, young American, nubile American women. I believe nubile is the operative term, who ate food on a regular basis and had all their own teeth and didn't wear layers of clothing like Irish women did, where you kind of needed a bookmark to find them, those layers of sweaters. And I remember I arrived in the place, in the little beach resort that I was going to be working in, and not a woman in the place. It's like a Foreign Legion reunion, and I couldn't quite figure it out. And it was just before the holiday season was about to start. And the night before the official start of holiday season, there was a bar across the road from the apartment I had called the Blue Moon Bar. And that opened for business and began playing a lot of Bee Gees, a lot of village people, quite a lot of disco. And had a lot of gentlemen on the balcony, very nice gentlemen who waved politely as I went into my apartment. Yeah. And it turned out that where I was working was Rehoboth Beach, which is known, I didn't know, the nation's gay summer capital. Okay. So lovely people, but not my market, really. And so I ended up in then going up to Maine, where there were apparently women and trees and things. And so when I came to write my books, I wanted to give Parker, the detective at the heart of the series, an affection and familiarity with the place that I had affection for. But also, it was virgin territory. In that, as Lauren was saying, if you write about New York or Boston or Chicago, especially if you're writing crime fiction, those are cities that have been colonized so often that it's actually very difficult to find something new to say about them. And when you write, you're writing in the shadow of all of these writers who went before you and all of these characters that have pre-existed. And whereas in Maine, for some reason, people in Maine had a kind of cringe factor. And that's sometimes true about the places that we come from. We can sometimes have a bit of a cringe factor about using them as locations because we think, well, actually, you're so familiar with it. And, you kind of go, nothing extraordinary ever happens in Stanley or Wakefield. It just doesn't. They're not those kinds of places. And people in Maine were a little bit like that. Whereas coming from outside, you look at the place and what you see is everything that's extraordinary about it. Because it's all new to you. And so for Maine, this state that had a million people, but you could drop Ireland into it four or five times, that had a very reasonably wealthy, liberal, lower southeastern part of the state, but the rest of it was poor and very conservative and didn't quite like outsiders, and it's a frontier state, and it has a history, and all of those things become very appealing to a writer. Because as a writer, we should be magpies. You're forever looking for the shiny thing that someone else has missed. And whether it's about the place that you live in or a place that you visited. And it does help, as Lauren has pointed out. The worst piece of advice you can give a writer is to say, write what you know. Because, you go, well, if you're born in Bradford and you went to school here and you became an accountant here, then the only thing you're equipped to write about is being an accountant in Bradford. Whereas know what you write about is actually much broader. So if you do want to write about somewhere, when I was writing my first novel, I remember maxing out my credit card with my then girlfriend because I knew that I wasn't going to write about Ireland. I didn't want to write about Ireland. I wanted to get away from it. But I knew that if I was going to write about somewhere, I needed to go to those places. So I used some of the places that I'd worked when I was younger because at least I knew what they were and I knew what they were like. And then went, because I had been very influenced by James Lee Burke, And I wanted to write about parts of Louisiana. So you go to Louisiana. The only time I could afford to go to Louisiana was August. Because nobody in their right minds wants to be in Louisiana in August, so everything is quite cheap. Admittedly, you walk around feeling like you've got a hairdryer on your head all the time. But it was useful.
A wet hairdryer, yeah.
But it was useful. And I mean, in my bag, I have, I'll show it to you before, because it's a useful thing to have. I used to do things like, I know about Lauren, that I used to, if I saw something interesting, I'd photograph it with my phone. And then you end up with just loads of crap on your phone that you never look at. So now I've gone back to keeping a little moleskin notebook, and I bring it with me everywhere. And I have a little pencil. And if I spot something interesting in the paper, I cut it out of the paper, and I stick it in the notebook, and when I go home, I'll tape it in. And I'll write down something interesting that I find. Anything at all. It could be something that it's just interesting at the time. And I might use it later, and I might not. But now it's there. And even the fact of writing it down becomes useful. It lodges in your head in a completely different way. And I think it's a really useful exercise to have if you are trying to write, is to keep something beside you that just accumulates those little details about places and people and things that add that air of veracity to what you're doing.
Yeah, I do take a lot of photographs, and then I also do a lot of interviews and talk to people and then kind of transcribe it. And often, like, the stuff people tell, you know, Broken Monsters is set in Detroit and it's set in the art scene, and there is stuff people told me that is verbatim in the book, which is the wildest parts, actually, where, you know, somebody was ice skating and they were playing ice hockey in an abandoned building that had frozen over, and they found two shoes sticking out of the ice. And unfortunately, an unhoused person had fallen and drowned, and then the ice had frozen over. But it was just these mad, mad stories. And an artist had died, so what they did was they had his funeral, and somebody had a Ouija board tattooed on his chest, and they did like a Ouija board reading. It's like, what? So it's all in the book, but I think people are like, oh, that's a bit much, don't you think?
I mean, it's interesting what you're saying about sort of familiarity and maybe over-familiarity with the place. Do you think it's easier, or in some ways you can take a step back from a place that you don't live in or you haven't lived in, rather than maybe your hometown? Is it perhaps more difficult to write a novel set in the place you grew up because you are so familiar and there's so many details that you may be tempted to put in?
I mean, there's good and bad, isn't there? Mm. There's good and bad in the fact that, you know, I set a novel called The Lovers in because it was dealing with Parker's father. So it was going to touch on New York in the 60s. But quite obviously, I didn't grow up in New York in the 60s. And I didn't have that shorthand. And suddenly you're writing a historical novel. And you're trying to reconstruct details that you don't have first-time access to. And you will make mistakes. There's no two ways about it. When I remember somebody pointing out to me that I had a character drinking a beer at the table in his kitchen. And somebody wrote to me and pointed, well, actually, that beer wasn't available in New York until after 1970-something. Yeah. It was only sold west of the Rockies. That was part of the deal. So there are little things that you will do wrong. So that's the disadvantage, is that if you're going to pick somewhere else, you're going to have to do an awful lot more research. But as Lauren was pointing out, we can be a bit sheepish, I think, especially when we're starting out, about going forward and asking people for assistance.
People love it. They absolutely love it.
Because actually, there are two things. Firstly, people hate it when you get stuff wrong because it pulls them out of the book. Those errors in a book pull people out of the reality of the book and they start doubting everything else in the book. It's a terrible, terrible thing. But the other thing is most people are never going to write their own stories. They're just not going to get around to writing a book. And actually, as we're all journalists, we're all ex-journalists, one of the things journalism taught me that is that every life, if you look at it in enough detail, is interesting. You know, even the bloke who seems so boring has there's a really interesting life in there somewhere. They're never going to write it down, and they're never going to tell anybody about it. And so if you approach somebody who has an area of specialization, they're often to tedious lengths, quite willing to share with you stories and the things that they know about it. You know, so people are out there as a kind of resource for you to use. And it's much easier now, especially with the internet. When I began writing, there was a primitive internet. I think it was Ask Jeeves when I started writing. And also, I remember the Irish Times had just before I left, which would be 1998, had just installed an internet terminal because they wanted journalists to learn how to use it. And nobody would use it because we were all frightened of it. And we all thought that if we went into it and we did something wrong, we'd break the internet. You know. So it's much easier now to do a lot of this research than it was before. The unfortunate thing is we all turn into Donald Rumsfeld, that there are known unknowns, unknown unknowns, and unknown, unknown unknowns. You know, you don't know what you don't know until you make the mistake, in a way. I guess that's a long way of answering the question.
But I think also, you know, like, talking to people, the way people express themselves will be ways that you wouldn't have thought of. So one of the people I interviewed in Detroit, I went to go and work in a soup kitchen for the day, and then, you know, everyone knew I was there, and I served people food, and then I went and sat at the tables and talked to people and asked them about their lives. And the one guy who I based my character TK on, he described himself as a thug nerd, so he did the IT support, but he also had a walking stick with a blade hidden in it. And when he was 13, he lived in what he called abandominiums. Mm. And again, that's not a word I would have ever come up with on my own. And he was the landlord, and they'd move in, and they'd rejig the electricity, and they'd, like, run some water in from a neighboring house. He said the trick to do it was to put up cheap curtains, and then people thought you were legit. But because he was a 13-year-old kid, he couldn't be the landlord. Wow. So he paid this Korean woman to come pretend to be the landlord and take money from all the other kind of unhoused people he was living with. And that level of detail is amazing. And and transcribing hours and hours of interview as a journalist, that's what taught me dialogue. Because you're constantly listening for, in what journalism is, the pull quote, which is kind of the highlighted quote in the magazine article or the newspaper. But it's the line of dialogue which tells you something about the person or moves something or is like amazing subtext. And I really credit like journalism and those hours of interviews to actually understanding how people speak and speak differently.
Absolutely, yeah. And with kind of like local flavor and dialect and stuff, that's a bit of a balance to attack as a writer. It's like, on the one hand, you've got kind of like Irving Welsh and Trainspotting, which is sort of like completely immersed in the dialect of his characters and even localized neighborhoods. But publishers don't like that too much, do they? If you put too much sort of dialect and too much idiom into speech, so that's a balance you have to think about when you're writing in a specific location.
If you're not from the place,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, it becomes slightly awkward and it's a bit cringy.
And you hit stereotypes and things like that.
But I mean, occasionally, I think in a sentence to have. You know, there are often interesting words, single words that people will use in one region that they won't use in another. Just, you know, a very tiny thing. And slipping one of those in occasionally unmediated without explaining what anybody, you know, what it is to anybody, let the context do it. That's often enough. You don't need, you know, 50 pages of dialect. What you need is often just one or two tiny telling details. Mm. That's usually it. It's one or two details that add veracity to what you're doing. Because we can get carried away, I think, and a lot of us, I certainly was guilty of it in my first novel, just getting carried away with research. Because you're finding out all of this stuff and you feel obliged to put it all in, having gone to the trouble of learning it, that you feel you should put it in. And it's an error, I think, that writers often get criticized for it in their first novels, because I think we're all quite guilty of it, is that you do tend to put too much into your first novel, because you think you might never get another chance. And also because you feel that it adds veracity to what you do. The writer Ross MacDonald was much more generous about that than others. He said that a writer's first novels was an index to that writer's interest for the rest of their career, in that everything that you will write about later, if you make a career out of novels, out of fiction, will be in your first novel in some shape or form. All of those things that seemed like extraneous details were clearly all things that mattered to you at the time. And I think that ended up being true for me, because I can see things in the first novel that became the seed of something in the 20th or 25th novel. It was all there at the beginning, because I think it's an impulse when you're writing your first book to put everything that you know up until that point into it. And everything that you've tried to experience, you try and put some element of it in there.
And especially when you've done a lot of research, you think like, you know, I've put the hours in here, I've done a lot of work, and it's... I remember... a novel I wrote about 7 years ago, I needed to sort of briefly describe a spacewalk and ended up reading some like 147-page NASA manual.
And then wrote 147 pages of the walk.
Like that. So there is a temptation to think like, oh, I've done all this work and I know all this stuff and I need to get it in when you're kind of like early days as a writer, really, isn't there? And that's something you need to...
So I think it's also, you know, like you should always be able to kill your darlings. But when I was researching Zoo City, I went to... the Central Methodist Church, which is a church where a lot of apartheid activists like hid out at the time in central Johannesburg. And at the time, there was something like 5,000 Africans from other African countries, refugees, who were living there because there'd been this wave of xenophobic violence of black South Africans against black Africans. And I went to the church because I wanted to set a scene there, and it was so overwhelming. You know, there were all these people there. I attended the service with Bishop Paul Verheyen's permission, and I was sitting next to a nurse, Mary, in an immaculate white linen suit, but there was a man kind of sprawled out in one of the other seats in the pew with, like, bare feet, and it looked like he'd walked here from the Congo. And at the end of the service, Mary said, "Do you want to see where I sleep?" And I said, "Yes, that'd be amazing, thank you. Let me just check with the bishop if that's okay." And so she took me down, and we went from this quite joyous church service. The bishop was also enraged that people had to live like this. You know, it was completely unacceptable that the city is not supporting you. We're now trying to get down to the basement where the women sleep, and it's like the lights are flickering, and we're trying to get through the staircase, and people are just shoving and like trying to find a place to sleep, and the men are like maybe camping down on a piece of concrete stair because that's what's available to them. If you're lucky, you've got a piece of cardboard to lie on. And we get down to the basement. It's about four times the size of this room. It's all women, standing room only. Some of them are bathing babies in buckets. And some of those babies are a result of rape at the border because that's what it costs to get across the border. And it was just shocking. It was like so shocking and overwhelming and moving and depressing and enraging. And I staggered out of there, and I was with a Zimbabwean guy, and most of the people we'd spoken to were Zimbabwean, who was my fixer and my translator. Mm. And my nice friends from the nice suburbs picked us up in the car, and they're like, how was it? Tell us everything. And I was still trying to process. Mm. And Johnston, my fixer, said, it was pathetic. Those people were pathetic. And I was like, what? Because, you know, he's Zimbabwean, black Zimbabwean, and that could have been him and his family. And so like, the scene was so big, I was like, if I wrote about this, it would have to become the entire book. Like, there's no way to put this in. Mm. And I was also really interested in his idea that it was pathetic and this kind of disassociation, which, of course, people were doing as well. They were trying to fight to find somewhere to sleep. And I realized that that's what fiction does so powerfully, is it gives us one perspective. So what I did was I took that, and I knew I couldn't write this into the book, but I took one character and made them a refugee and used him as a way of exploring this. And because you have that one perspective, and you're with that person, you can feel things for them. And it's not this mass of people that's overwhelming. So it was really interesting to be able to find that perspective.
Yeah, which is interesting, because if you had just read about that in sort of a report or watched a documentary about it, you wouldn't have those differences of perspective on the personal level.
We do tend to bring, you know, it is the difficulty of being a human being, I suppose, certainly if you're going to be a human being who's going to be a writer, that you bring your prejudices or your assumptions about things to everything that you do. It's inevitable. And one of the advantages, I think, of being open to reading and to talking to people is that you do get those perspectives challenged. I remember I was in New York, just completely by accident, so I was doing a thing for my publishers, and Associated Press had launched a book, a history of their best photographs. And there was a launch in a Barnes & Noble, and there were only about five people at it. But some of the most famous photographers from Associated Press were at this thing explaining. There was a guy called Eddie Oliver, I think was his second name. He took that very famous photograph from the Vietnam War of a Viet Cong prisoner being executed, being shot in the head by a South Vietnamese general. It's an iconic picture because he captured it at the moment that the bullet strikes. It's an amazing piece of photography. And it's often held up as a, you know, man's inhumanity to man. You know, this is, you know, this appalling act of summary execution on the street. And he was asked about it because they were showing the slides on them, a bit like here. And he said, you know, he said, the only thing I regret about that photo, he says, is that I ruined the general's life. Mm. He said, you know, he said, everybody looked at this photo and he was persecuted afterwards for this. He said, everybody said, you know, how could you do this to another human being? And he said, actually, that the guy that he had shot, he said, had been a sniper who'd been killing his men for about the previous week. So he had watched all of his being whittled down, and eventually they caught this guy. And he said, it was a war, you know, he said, and what happened was terrible on both sides. But he said, because the general was photographed, it was quite clearly him. You know, he never recovered from having this photo taken. And it's an odd perspective to take on it. It's not something anybody looking at that photo would think, would go, God, the poor general. Mm. And so to be open to those experiences of other people, to be open to other words, and it makes you, there's a very, especially when, as Lauren and I do occasionally write about kind of darker individuals, it is tempting to demonize them a little bit. And there's a very famous Mitchell and Webb sketch of two Nazis in a trench. We've seen this great sketch where they're, one turns to the other and says, you know how we're wearing, we have skull and crossbones on our lapels? And he goes, yeah, and we wear these black uniforms. He goes, yeah, and everybody hates us. And he goes, yeah. He says, do you think we're the bad guys? And it's really, there's a real truth to that, because actually most people don't do bad things because they want to be intrinsically evil. Most people do bad things because they're frightened or they're scared or they're jealous or they're envious or they're in love. And they can. The terrible thing about human motivation is that we can justify some of the awful things that we do to ourselves.
I think we're all justify things constantly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that again, to be open to those, to that difference of perspective, as Lauren was talking about with Johnston in the basement.
So it's also interesting because, you know, we're talking about world building, but like a beautiful world is nothing if you don't have interesting characters.
Yeah, yeah.
And they do need to have those motivations, and they should be conflicted, and they should be complicated. And Amber in Bridge is my favorite villain because she is a middle-aged lady with a small dog called Mr. Floof 2, and everyone underestimates her. But she's previously served in the army, and she's trying to kill the protagonist, and she's awful, and she like uses horrendous torture methods. But if you get into her story, you kind of get where she's coming from. Like, she has a really good justification. She's seen what this artifact can do, and it really destroyed one of her friends, and she sees herself as this kind of hunter to, like, you know, this parasite control to, like, stop the spread of this thing and to stop it affecting other people the same way it affected her friend. And she was so fun to write because I really felt for her. Whereas, you know, with The Shining Girls, which is about time traveling serial killer and broken monsters, I didn't have empathy. I was writing, like, horrible, horrible men. But I think trying to find that connection is really interesting. That makes your world work.
Yeah. Because, as you say...
Otherwise, you've got a screensaver, you know?
The people are most important, even the side characters. We started off saying that location is
a character.
Is a character. Have you ever started a book or a short story not knowing where it's set, or do you always have a sense of place when you start writing?
I think I always have a sense of place. Mm. And it's always interesting to, like, find interesting details.
And do you think maybe if you look back at some of the novels you've written, would they be different novels if they were set in a different place?
Definitely. The reason I set The Shining Girls in Chicago, which immediately made it more commercial, was because it's about a time-traveling serial killer. Mm. And the same way, you know, like, and if I set a time-travel novel in South Africa, it would have to become about overthrowing apartheid. Like, there's no way around it. Like, the novel would absolutely have to become that. So I think place is very important, and it is distinctive. And I do think coming with an outsider's perspective is really, really interesting, because you do find the cracks, you do find the things which other people overlook.
And it's not just a sort of physical geographic location that your world is. There's the history that and the social
and the psychogeographies,
that have led up to that. Yeah.
Yeah, psychogeography. That's become increasingly interesting. That notion of.
Does everyone know what psychogeographies is?
Yeah, that place. That it's like the sense that I suppose you always think of layers of history, and not just. The history of the people who live there. It's almost like that we leave an imprint on the city as we move through it. So, and Bradford's really interesting in that way, because you walk around and you see you've still got these gorgeous old buildings from the 19th century still there. And I suppose psychogeography is interesting in that sense that these places retain a kind of residual memory, a kind of historical memory and a psychological memory from the people who've passed through them. And then it becomes linked into weird things like ontology and things.
I love ontology.
Which is one of those, that idea that the past is never really the past and that there are all these layerings to it. Yeah, so that kind of conception. And I guess if you're writing about a place that exists, that you have that history, that psychogeography to draw on immediately. And if you don't, you have to create it. You have to give people a sense of history. And King is quite good at that, I think, that sense of those towns that he creates, that they have layers. And then I guess if you get to write long enough, you get to create your own history, like King has, where you can refer back to characters who were in previous books, or they can drift into the background of another narrative, and the reader gets this sense of a much larger universe out there.
I do have to say, you should try and avoid doing that in your own writing, because...
Oh, you look like an arse.
No, sure. But also, you know, so I had one evil biotech company in Moxieland called Innotech, and then I used it again in a short story, and the short story got optioned, and I had to change the name, because they were like, well, if Moxieland ever gets optioned, it's going to, like, affect us. So, yeah. I mean, may that be my problem. But, you know, that's... you do have to actually think about, like... You know, unless it's a world where you have one detective, fine. But if you are writing different worlds and different stories which are completely unrelated, maybe don't have those through lines, because it's going to become like an IP issue at some point, hopefully.
Yeah. Hopefully, definitely.
Can we just talk about authenticity readers?
Yes.
I think that's really important.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they used to be called... So sensitivity readers, I think, is a more common term. But I think authenticity reader is better, because sensitivity implies that people are being oversensitive.
Yeah.
And authenticity is like you're trying to write authentically into an experience. So I did this with Zoo City, which came out in 2010. I was writing a black protagonist. And I was like, okay, I just really want to make sure I don't screw this up. And I hired a friend of mine who's also a novelist to read it for me. And people weren't really doing it at that time. But since then, I kind of always try to do it. And, you know, I've made mistakes as well. But I think it's really important, if you're writing about something that you don't know, whether that's a place, I try and get people from the place, like, you know, that I've hung out with to read the book. But especially if you're writing outside your own lived experience, which all of us are, if we're not writing about being a journalist, you know, or an accountant or whatever, you know. Yeah. And no, I think it's just really important.
I kind of disagree entirely.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
Go for it.
Yeah, no, the thing is, I just don't. I'm not very convinced by the argument about the ideas of sensitivity or authenticity. It's perhaps more common. It hasn't really infiltrated mystery fiction at all. And I think in part it's because I remember interviewing Becky Chambers, who I think is a really interesting science fiction writer, young science fiction writer. And we were talking about why science fiction in particular seemed to attract, for a long time, really quite appalling men. You know, fantasy didn't have quite the same problem. Science fiction had a real difficulty with right-wing, frequently misogynist and racist men. And she said, actually, the difficulty with fiction, science fiction and fantasy writing is that it often attracts, not difficulty, but a factor in it, is that it attracts people who are dissatisfied with the world the way it is and are then creating alternative versions of it. And some of those people will be liberal or will be LGBTQ plus or will be, especially during the 70s and second wave feminism, will be women who are trying to write these alternative universes. She said some inevitably will be conservative and male or female and responding to changes that they're uncomfortable with. And those people tend to be slightly more sensitive to depictions in fiction. And in that case, even then, I would still be doubtful about it. And I've written, I mean, central to my books are a pair of gay characters, one of whom is black. At no point have I ever run either of those books, any of those characters, by anybody of either that race or that sexual motivation. And I remember doing an event in Stacy's bookstore, which is now no more, in San Francisco. A guy arrived with about 14 copies of Dark Hollow in paperback.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody does that and wants some sign, you kind of want to, just in case he's not playing with the full deck of cards. And, you know, moments later, his mum goes, oh, I didn't buy another 14 copies of the same book. And I have to pay, she's kind of, we're going to be broke with him doing this. And I said to him very politely, you do know that you have 14 copies of exactly the same book. And he said, yeah, I said, I run a gay men's reading group.
Aww.
And he said, you know, for so long, he said, we were either reading books in which gay men were unhappy or Armistead Maupin. Yeah. And that was kind of the two poles. I said, it was just quite nice to read a book in which there were just two individuals who were not defined by their sexuality. The same way I'm not, don't wake up in the morning and think, my God, I'm heterosexual. You know, we're not defined by them in that way. And I think it would have been the cherry on the cake had I been gay myself. That would have just capped it for him. But he didn't really mind. What was about capturing a certain truth to human experience. And I suppose my view is that actually we're, as writers, I'm not writing books about the black experience, and I'm not writing books about the gay experience, but I move through a world which is inhabited by people who are all kinds of skin colors and all kinds of sexualities. And it's more recognizing that they are there. And that whatever I write about is inevitably to some degree going to be filtered through my consciousness, but you treat everybody as a human being, essentially. But I am uncomfortable with it, I have to say, about authenticity reading. And I have a young friend who, the first time they came to one of my signings, they were still, they were female. I remember dressed as Sherlock Holmes, an eccentric child. and they have now transitioned and they go by the name of Felix. And actually, probably identify as male now, I think. And they are working as sensitivity readers. Mm. We agree not to talk about it. that we have a difference of opinion on this. And it may be generational, I think, as well, perhaps. But it's interesting to hear your perspective. Mm.
Yeah, I think it's an often difficult situation for a writer, especially a writer starting out, because kind of on the one hand, they're told to have a lot of diversity in books, but on the other hand, don't tell stories that are not yours to tell, in a way. So it's almost conflicting information or conflicting sort of...
Yeah. I guess it depends on we'll probably meet in the middle ground with the centrality of the character that you're writing
about. Yeah, exactly,
if I'm not going to write a book like Percival Everett's James. Mm. That's not my book to write. Mm. But I think to be aware that you need to reflect the reality of the life around you.
I think that's so important to write the world that you know and also the world that you don't know, and to also be brave. Mm. But also not to fall into a terrible cliche.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Have either of you ever written in a world, a completely made up sort of fantasy world? Or
yeah, I've written some sci-fi stories that are like, yeah.
That
But there's always like a basis in kind of reality, you know. Mm. So I have a short story which is set in kind of a prison, which I base on Abu Ghraib and Philip Zimbardo's book about like the atrocities and the torture which happened in Abu Ghraib, but it's just on an alien planet. But it is about that kind of losing your humanity.
Yet you're always writing about this. When I wrote science fiction, I remember putting together a presentation for schools because I put together a lot. It was lots of film. And the first question I would always ask them was, where is science fiction set? And inevitably people would go, well, science fiction is usually set in the future. And you point, well, actually, science fiction is always about the present and the past. It's always about that. But it's usually people using the future as a prism through which to refract present experience. Yeah. And one of the things I often showed them was the opening, the part of the original Planet of the Apes. That moment when they arrive on the planet and they think we're going to rule this place, we'll be in charge of this place in 6 months, and you hear this horn sound, and the next minute the apes come out on horseback and begin hunting the humans, and it's a fantastic sequence. And then I would show them, I would say, well, contemporaneously, what would you be watching on the news at the time? And you show them the race riots, and you show them black people having hoses turned on them by white people, and then there's a sequence in Planet of the Apes where you see Charlton Heston being hosed down by a pair of gorillas. And suddenly they get it. This thing that appears to have no relation to them at all is out there. And there's a really interesting, Daryl Zanuck, who was the producer, is interviewed, and he says, well, I never saw any of that, he said. Yeah. I just saw it as a film about apes and humans on a planet. And you can see him almost lying to himself, because he would have had to go to Southern Theatre Owners, and if they asked him out straight, he'd have had to admit it. Mm. Yeah. So he had convinced himself that this thing, that it was quite patently, even when the screenwriter went on and said, yeah, it was obviously social commentary. He didn't want to see it. He didn't want to see it, you know, and he was an intelligent man. But I think that's, you're always filtering. Everything you write is filtered through your consciousness.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any questions?
You talked a lot about place and, I guess, kind of authenticity of places. And one of the things I'm struggling and something I'm writing with is I feel a need to fictionalize a place. But you know, like it's very definitely this particular city, but like a slightly different fictionalized version. Are there any kind of traps or don'ts about how to do that in a way that makes it feel like it's this actual place, but you're not like potentially being like libelous or anything about stuff?
Well, all writers mythologize places. You know, we don't write the world as it really is. We write the world as it is filtered through our consciousness. You're quite entitled to mythologize. I mean, you know, libelous, that's they're into a different area. You know, it's generally just a very good idea, unless we got clearance to change names, whether it's names of places or names of people, just avoid making things recognizable. You do have a kind of get-out clause at the front of your book that says, you know, everything is free. But actually, if you name the bloke at number 43 and said number 43 is a pedo, then actually you're probably going to be in trouble with the bloke at number 43. But in general, we mythologize places. It's about truth and reality are not the same thing. They're different things. Making something feel real. Truth is more important than reality, the essential truths about something. And you can do that in mythologizing a place. You can still communicate truths about people and truths about the nature of the place. You're asking is a really interesting question. But it is true that, you know, my Portland is not the Portland of the Portland Tourist Board or somebody who lived there. Lawrence, Cape Town and Johannesburg are not necessarily Cape Town and Johannesburg as they are. They're these cities filtered through the consciousness of somebody who's quite sensitive to certain aspects of it. And you should feel free to use those. And actually, sometimes it's much more interesting to mythologize a place, to create a slightly, almost like the shadow cast by the place or the reflection of it in water that's flowing slightly. That's what you can do. Creating a kind of ultra-realist depiction of a city is not what novelists do. You know, we try to do something slightly more interesting than that. So you have a great deal of freedom to do what you want to do, I think.
I think that's great. But also find interesting details, which are, you know, when I was in Detroit, we were exploring this abandoned building, movie theater, and there was like rotting chairs in the theater, and one had been pulled out like a rotten tooth, and I was writing all of that down. But then there were black squirrels in the grass. And that was just really, really interesting. So like find the details that you can hang things on, and then you can mythologize around that. If you give people details, they love that.
Yeah, I think it's kind of more important to give a flavor of a place or a city rather than sort of plotting someone's exact route through every street that the drive to get from one place to another.
Yeah, think about the things that you find fascinating about the place. When you look at it, what are the things that leap out at you and that you think add color to it? And there are probably four or five very specific things that you like about your city or that you find interesting about the place that you live in. And those are the things that you latch onto. And because you can get overwhelmed. It's a city. It's a big city. There's all of this choice. And it's a very good thing at the beginning to kind of limit yourself a little bit and think, okay, well, what am I writing? You go into back to the journalist thing of the who, what, where, when, and why. And the where is the big thing here. And then say, okay, within that, what are the things that are important? What is the backdrop? If this was a theater, what would be the backdrop that I would want for this? What would I use? And then you can see what you're going to do. And then you can start working on those things. You know, not everything has to be sketched in similar detail, because it's actually quite overwhelming, unless you're going to be Dickens or Leo Tolstoy. And frankly, we've had them, you know. And if you want to be Bradford's Leo Tolstoy, then God bless you, you know.
But I just add that, like, also think about other senses. So think about sounds, like so ambient sounds, and, like, it helps to go and sit there. And also smell. Like, people underuse smell.
So following on from that, and you mentioned about details into your world, but going back to world building, if you're creating an alternative universe or parallel or portal, if you've described if you could say the real world as regards to what that world is, when you're going through the parallel universe or the parallel portal, do you have to do that again, or is it more about this, if you could say, the plot from the character going through that? Or do you have to put in some, if you could say, Easter eggs for the reader just to make it different from the actual world, even though it's a parallel world and it's similar?
So this is exactly my novel Bridge, which is the, you know, you can do a Freaky Friday body swap across realities. So I would Freaky Friday with the other Lauren, and she's suddenly sitting in a stadium full of people going, oh my God, I was just on the toilet. What is happening? But I put little Easter eggs and I put little details in, because it wasn't Everything Everywhere All at Once is the perfect mother-daughter alternate reality story. Mine is the second best. But that was like weird worlds, you know, and like sausage fingers and, you know, raccoons and rocks. Mine is, I wanted to do a mundane reality. You know, it was about the choices we make. But there are little Easter eggs. So gradually in the book, this isn't a spoiler, you start to realize, because I'm talking about UVID instead of YouTube, and President Harris, and they've managed to deal with COVID much better than we have, you're like, oh, they're in a different reality. They're not in our reality. So trust your reader. Like, put in little details. Give them Easter eggs. You know, if you're going to an entirely fantastical world where, you know, alien plants are, like, trying to eat you, by all means, go into the detail again. But if it's an alternate reality that's very close to ours, it's going to be unnerving for your characters to find those weird details that are different. And it's also going to be great for your readers, especially if your reader notices it before the character does.
Yeah, I think it's there may be a kind of a drive to sort of
overexplain,
put too much exposition in about to have characters explain, and no one would sit there sort of like talking.
Let me tell you how the tube works.
Yes, yeah. And isn't Hugh Grant have best prime minister we've ever had, and sort of thing, and it's you'd drop that in more casually, wouldn't you, and sort of paint those pictures. Did you have another
sorry, the sorry, movie Children of Men does this so brilliantly, where there's constantly stuff in the background happening, so it's not characters sitting being like, oh no, it's terrible, we're keeping people in cages. It's stuff on the news, it's posters in the window, they walk through the, you know, train station and there are people in cages, but nobody mentions it. Because it's just so normal. So remember that it is normal for the people who live there, and they're not seeing it. Oh, sorry, the other thing is, if you're doing, like, big genre swings, your rules have to be consistent. Like, you know, like, if you're using magic, if you're using time travel, if you're using parallel realities, you have to know how it works. You can't just, like, you know, wibbly-wobbly hand-wave things away.
Wing it.
Yeah, totally. Like, you actually, it doesn't matter if the rules don't make sense or are completely impossible, as long as they're consistent and always applies. you know, so dragons can't suddenly speak, and time travel suddenly, you know, makes you turn into a giant blob. Like, it, you have to set up from the beginning.
You've talked a lot about geographical place, and I just wondered, with the rise of social media and sort of popular culture and all that kind of thing, is there a, I'm trying to write a book at the moment which has got music as a theme through it. I'm really struggling with setting, and I'm wondering whether there's a different type of place that I'm, this is a sort of a thinking out loud question, but is there a, can you think of any examples where people have used worlds that aren't geographical, geographically based? Do you know what I mean?
So sonically based?
Sonically based or culturally, or they've created their own world and brought their own kind of tribes and beliefs with them. So they might, I guess maybe they're in, therefore then in a geographical place. But
I think that's also an inner world, which is...
It's an inner world, yeah. I think, is there a group inner world, a collective inner world that you could get to rather that isn't geographically based?
I mean, social media for sure, yeah. You know, and I've definitely used Reddit threads and like chats on that. Again, my novel Amber has a connection to all the other Ambers, and it becomes this kind of psychic space where they can talk to each other. My instinct, not knowing anything about your book, my instinct would be to write from first person, because then you can have that inner world and like really see what she or he is feeling. And yeah,
I remember interviewing the musician Kristen Hirsch from Toy Music, and she's synesthetic, so you know, she sees music as color, which I've always struggled, because I'm not synesthetic. I can't conceptualize that notion at all, that somebody that I something that I experience very much through one sense, she experiences through two senses. And I think Lauren's probably right. If you're going to write that kind of book, then it makes sense to do it from a first-person perspective, because then you have a degree of freedom to explain things that actually would be very difficult if you're doing it in the third person, I suppose, because then you get everything becomes that character's experience, possibly.
You were talking about speaking to people and interviewing them and getting their stories. So I wondered, first of all, if you say, ask 10 people, how many people would speak to you? And whether there's a difference when you go up and go, hi, I'm John Connolly, I'm a Sunday Times bestseller, compared to, hi, I'm John Connolly, I'm working on my first book. You know, whether people are willing to talk to you and how they approach you.
I mean, maybe it gets a little bit easier. But in general, you're funny, you'd be surprised how little you get knocked back. I mean, you know, something like the NYPD, who have a gazillion people asking them every week, can they go and sit in the back of a police car, are probably going to tell you to take a run and jump because they have other things to be doing. But, you know, if you, just to take that example, you know, all these police departments have retired policemen's associations, and they often direct people who are curious to these people. And like I said, most people are quite happy to sit down and talk with you. If you're genuine, if you're not wasting somebody's time, if you say, look, you make it quite clear, I'm only going to take up X amount of your time, and these are the two or three topics that I'd really like to ask you about. And even if they just want to do it by email, to open that channel of communication. But actually, people are reasonably decent.
And they want to tell their stories.
They do, they really do.
And they
do.
Want you to understand, they want you to get it right. Like, don't get it wrong. I've seen cops done so many times badly as a cop. You know, they're like, please just get it right. And I think that's really important. I think also, you know, I took the Detroit Cops donuts, and I often take people out to lunch. You know, you make it worth their while as well. And then often, you know, I might check back in with them so they feel like they have some kind of ownership. And I always acknowledge everyone as well in the acknowledgements.
Yeah. My mother always says, don't arrive with your hands hanging anywhere. You know, never hurts to bring something along with you as a sweetener.
Brilliant. Thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you found that interesting and useful. And Lauren and John, thank you.
Cheers. Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.